David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to be talking about finding a genetic basis for the placebo effect, using lasers to locate meteor craters, and finally, what Tony Soprano has in common with amoebas.
Well, let's start with the genetic basis of the placebo effect. This is the effect in which you don't actually get a medicine, but you still have a good outcome.
Exactly. You know, think of a clinical trial where one group of patients would get the actual medication and another group would get, say, a sugar pill. And what scientists have known for a long time is that sometimes even these people that get the sugar pills get better. And this is known as the placebo effect.
And there's some genetic component to this?
Well, the idea is that even though we've known about the placebo effect for a long time, there's still a lot of mystery about what goes on in our body that makes us respond in this way to fake medication.
So what these researchers do?
Well, these researchers built on previous studies that had shown that the neurotransmitter dopamine might be somehow responsible for the placebo effect. When we anticipate a therapy, it's kind of like anticipating a reward. And dopamine is tied to the reward pathway in our brain. And when our brain releases dopamine, it can reduce, say, the symptoms of chronic pain and depression. But another group of researchers said, well, what about other conditions, conditions that don't have anything to do with pain or depression? And they focused on a condition known as social anxiety disorder, or SAD. It's an abnormal fear of being judged by others. And one thing researchers know about SAD is that it seems to be tied to a neurotransmitter called serotonin. People with SAD tend to have overactive amygdalas, which is a region of our brain that's tied to the fear response, which makes sense if you're thinking about the symptoms of SAD. But they can also have variations in genes that are responsible for regulating the neurotransmitter serotonin, which has also been shown to be tied to a more active amygdala. And to see how the placebo effect might tie into this disorder, the researchers ran a clinical trial where they took 108 patients who had been diagnosed with SAD, and they gave half of them a serotonin medication, so a real drug, and they gave the other half a sugar pill, so a placebo. And during the course of the trial, they had these people prepare and give speeches in front of a small group of people, so something that would stimulate this social anxiety. And what they found is after the trial concluded after 8 weeks, 10 of the people that got the placebo got better. So they did experience the placebo effect. And what was really interesting is that these people had variations in this gene that was tied to serotonin production. So this is actually the first evidence that there's a genetic basis to the placebo effect, because people that had this particular variation were much more susceptible to the placebo effect than those that didn't have that genetic variation.
I imagine that's something that every pharmaceutical company would like to know, is more about the genetics of the people in the clinical trials.
It does raise some privacy issues.
Well, from finding a gene that's associated with the placebo effect to finding previously undiscovered meteor craters using a new laser system. What is this new laser system?
Well, this is a technology called LIDAR, and this has actually been around for a while, but this is a new application of the technology. But first, let's back up a bit. Earth is actually hit with a lot of meteors in its history, and especially over the past 12,000 years, about every decade or so, Earth has been hit with a sizable meteorite big enough to cause a crater about 40 meters wide. But we've only found about 5 of these craters so far. And that's because once these things strike Earth, they tend to erode before we can find them, or they're covered by lakes or forests or some other covering that makes them difficult to locate.
Other than curiosity, what's the point in finding these things in the first place?
Well, these meteors are a treasure trove of information for geologists and astronomers because they can provide information about our early solar system and how everything formed in the first place. So it's really important to find these craters, but scientists, as I've said, have had a very hard time doing so.
We've only found 5.
We've only found 5 so far. And so what this team did, getting back to LIDAR, is they employed this laser technology. And how it works is you're up in an airplane and you basically shoot laser beams down at the Earth and they bounce back. And as they bounce back, they give you very detailed topographical information. And what's great about LIDAR versus something like radar is that the lasers pierce things like lakes and forests. So they can give you very detailed information of the ground, even if it's covered by something. And employing the technology, the researchers are able to find a crater 36 meters wide in central Alberta, Canada, that had never been discovered before.
So we're up to six.
And further studies at the site revealed some fragments from the meteorite and also information about just how the meteorite crashed to Earth, what kind of orbit it was in, what kind of speed it was traveling at. And this is really important information, too, because it tells us where the meteorite may have come from, how it entered Earth, and things of that nature that also help shed light on the origins of the solar system.
So do you have to fly a plane over every single square kilometer of the Earth to use this LIDAR to find these craters?
Well, you don't necessarily have to do that. In fact, researchers often have a general sense of where a meteorite crashed. In fact, 2 weeks ago, there was a similarly sized meteorite that crashed somewhere in Canada that researchers haven't found yet, but they have a general idea of where it may have hit. So using LIDAR, they can scan that area and hopefully pinpoint the crater. But for older meteorites where we don't know where they would have hit, you would have to conduct a much broader search.
Well, from the search for missing meteorites to the search for the connection between Tony Soprano and an amoeba. First, who's Tony Soprano?
Well, for those of you out there who didn't watch The Sopranos, Tony Soprano was the chief mobster in a television show on HBO. And Tony Soprano, like a lot of mobsters, was known for valuing family above all else. And it turns out amoeba also value family above all else. And this story has to do with how amoeba find food. And it deals with a particular type of social amoeba known as Dictyostelium discoideum, if I'm saying that correctly. And this amoeba usually lives alone. It dines on bacteria on the forest floor. But when food becomes very scarce, it pals up with tens of thousands of its neighboring amoebae, and they form a blob, which is about a third the length of an eyelash. And it slithers much farther along the forest floor than any amoeba could. And when it finds an area that's more promising for food, it forms what's called a fruiting body. And what this is it looks like a little stalk. About 20% of the amoeba form a stalk. And the rest of the amoeba form this ball of spores on the top of the stalk. And as animals pass by, these spores get stuck on the animal. They get transferred to greener pastures where they can land on the ground and start feeding again. Well, the downside of this fruiting body is all of the amoeba that make up the stalk, because they don't get to get transferred. They basically sacrifice themselves for the good of the rest of the group.
And for the good of the family.
For the good of the family, exactly. And researchers have wondered, what's in it for them? Why would this 20% sacrifice themselves for the rest of the group? And they figured, as you said, it might have something to do with family. Perhaps if they know that they're helping family out, they're more likely to do it. But the researchers also wondered about cheaters. If you're an amoeba and you're forming a fruity body, obviously you want to be in the spore. You don't want to be in the stalk. So how do the amoeba protect themselves against cheaters? They're the ones that are going to stay out of the stalk and only go to the fruiting body, and they're going to sort of cheat their way into the next generation.
Keeping in mind that the amoeba actually don't know anything. They're just sensing it.
Right. We're anthropomorphizing here a little bit. What the researchers did was they took 14 different strains of amoeba and they paired them together with a laboratory strain of the same type of amoeba. Now, these 14 strains varied widely in how related they were to each other. Some were very closely related and some weren't related at all. And what they did was they also made the laboratory amoeba glow in the dark. Then they, one by one, mixed these amoeba together with the laboratory amoeba, and they starved them so that they would form these fruiting bodies. And what they found was that when the strains that were mixed were very closely related, they all mixed together in this fruiting body, and they were very well blended so that some of them were in the stalk and some of them were in the spore, so that the ones that died and the ones that would have passed on were members of both groups. But when they mixed amoeba that were distantly related or not related at all, what they found is they didn't come together to form a fruiting body. They formed their own fruiting bodies. They completely segregated. So one family, if you will, formed its own fruiting body, and the other family formed its own fruiting body.
So these earliest organisms are balancing cooperation with self-interest. Have the researchers figured out how they actually can tell the different families apart?
They don't know, but it is interesting that such a simple organism is able to tell friend from foe. I mean, this is something we usually associate with much more complex organisms, but it turns out even the humble amoeba can determine who is family and who's not. And you can see a really cool video of all the stuff I've been talking about, the fruiting body formation, the spore formation, on the site.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you covering on Science Now?
Well, Rob, in addition to covering all the science news from around the world, we've just started this brand new blog called Science Insider. And this is a really exciting endeavor for us. The blog's been running for a couple of weeks now, and it's breaking news from the world of science policy. So everything from how Obama's new advisors are going to affect science, to how the government's dealing with bioterrorism threats, to even where the UK government stands on smoking pot.
So there are international issues, too.
International issues. Everything in science policy that affects science, that affects research, that even affects your daily life. This is a very frequently updated blog. And there's also a link for feedback and tips. So if anybody out there has a tip, they can submit it on the site. So be sure to check out the site frequently for breaking science policy news.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus the Science Insider blog at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.